This Studio Sacramento episode is supported by UC Davis Health, where doctors, nurses, and researchers share a passion for advancing health. Learn more about their latest medical innovations at health.ucdavis.edu.
COVID-19 is still with us, and we are facing a winter of increasing infections and ever more strain on our healthcare system. As the state takes lockdown actions similar to those earlier this year, many of us have questions about what happens next. Joining us for answers is Vice Chancellor and CEO of UC Davis Health, Dr. David Lebarski. Dr. Lebarski, based on where we stand today, what should we all anticipate about the growth and severity of the pandemic between now and the end of the flu season?
Well, Scott, that's a great question, and one no doubt on everyone's mind. I think the most important thing about the next 5 months is that how it rolls out and what we should expect is in our control. Because if we continue on the way that we have been, where we are not paying sufficient attention to always masking when within 6 feet of others, at least indoors, not congregating indoors, and not actually exposing ourselves to the virus, we can change the curve and we can expect that our interventions in that regard will keep us relatively safe until the vaccine arrives. If we continue differently and we don't keep our distance and don't wear our masks when we're around others, we can expect an awful winter of too many avoidable deaths.
Well, when we talk about too many avoidable deaths, one of the issues that seems to be on everybody's mind is ICU capacity. Where does UC Davis stand on its ICU capacity right now?
Well, that's, again, something that we watch literally at least twice a day. We do a census. Currently, we have 21 of our 84 ICU beds filled with COVID-19 patients. But we never have any available ICU beds in general because we're constantly taking referrals from other hospitals around the region. And it is stressing us out that we're not actually able to take as many transfers now while we care for all of these COVID patients. Having said that, we're not anywhere near our capacity. We do have surge plans. We do have the ability to expand what we offer. We are ready to serve this region as necessary.
So as a region, we're not close to crossing the threshold where it is that we go into the highest level of lockdown status?
Oh, no, I'm afraid that they're basing it on non-surge, normal ICU capacity. And I believe that we will cross that threshold within the next couple of days, if regionally.
Along with ICU capacity itself, there's really the question of your colleagues and staff in centers of excellence like UC Davis Medical Center. What are the biggest challenges that your healthcare workers are facing right now?
Like everyone out there, there's COVID fatigue. And the biggest challenge is keeping our guard up, is making sure that every patient interaction is done in a safe way, both for the patient, for their family, and most especially for our workers. They can't let their guard down and not gown and glove exactly correctly because that's how the disease can spread among frontline workers. And the stress, the mental health stress of coming to work every day and knowing that your own health actually is at risk and that you have the potential to bring home a disease to your loved ones and your family have created a tsunami of mental health issues among all of our healthcare heroes. And I would just say that they're also tired of taking care of people who don't take care of themselves. They would really appreciate it if everybody listening to this show put on their mask out of respect for the people who are taking care of you.
Well, there is, as you know, there seems to be a growing divide between the healthcare community's reality that you and your colleagues are facing on the ground every single day, not just in your institution, but all across the United States and the general community. How did we get so far between the healthcare community's understanding of what it's going to take to fight and defeat this virus, and where the public's mood of growing skepticism is at today?
I wonder that myself, Scott, because, you know, as an academic physician and a scientist and who believes in data and truth, and that there is a single set of facts, we've deviated from that. We have allowed and frankly been encouraged by the current Washington administration to doubt what is true and to circulate misinformation and disinformation rather than science. We've allowed the wearing of a mask to become a political statement rather than a statement of public health and concern for one's fellow citizens. And you know, I like to point out that we accept all sorts of limitations on our quote unquote personal freedoms, where the exercise of those personal freedoms impact the life, liberty, or pursuit of happiness of others in our country. We don't let you speed at 120 miles an hour near a walkway, right? We don't let you run stop signs at will. We don't let you shoot a machine gun into the air in a crowded marketplace. So there are plenty of limitations that we have accepted in order to safeguard those around us. And wearing a mask is just that. It not only safeguards those around us, it safeguards you, right? And this has been studied. There is science. There is plenty of data. Masks work. And there's no doubt about it. And that's why unanimously every organization in medicine has come out and said, we must do this. This is how we protect each other.
Well, there is broad unanimity, as you say, related to the healthcare community's advocacy of masking. And you're correct in identifying it as an issue that somehow has migrated from a public health issue to a political issue. But part of this rebellion is people complaining about what they consider to be the arbitrariness of the public health establishment in establishing rules. You can do this, but you can't do that. And there seems to be at least a perception of inconsistency that is showing up in an increasing demand for people to, quote unquote, public health, show us the evidence that what you're saying actually makes sense because of the economic and mental health harm that many of these restrictions are causing within the public. How do you respond to that?
Well, I just want to frame this in a way that I don't think we've done well.
And by we, do you mean the public health establishment?
I mean we, our entire society in the United States, and the public health. The goal should never be zero disease transmission. I mean, it would be great if we could get there. We can't put that genie back in the bottle. So we're at a mitigation strategy. And it's just like, again, I'm going to use things that people really understand, highways. We don't stop driving because there's vehicular death, right? We also don't have a speed limit on our highways that's 25 miles an hour that would markedly reduce vehicular death on our highways. We make a trade-off between what is important to us in our life and some negative consequences of having speed limits of 55 and 65 miles an hour. This is the type of reasoning and thinking that has not been consistent across all the various public health jurisdictions. What is an acceptable level? And I think actually that in this case, both Governor Newsom and Secretary Galley have done an excellent job in defining that as when we get to the point where we are rationing care and we can no longer take care of the truly sick in our population, then we need to really clamp down on the spread and the transmission in a way that's more serious than previously. And I think the idea of ICU capacity as a rare resource and rate limiting step and judging the lockdown on that goal is very reasonable at this point in time, because it is trying to balance keeping our commercial and social interests ongoing while also making sure that those of us who do fall ill have somewhere to go.
Someone who agrees with you is a professor from McGill University. His name is Daniel Weinstock, and he's their head of health and social policy. And he wrote recently that the continued attempt to enforce prohibitions leads to the worst of all possible worlds, a kind of unregulated non-compliance that not only isolates people, but also is inegalitarian in that it distributes the burden of combating the virus on people who are the least able to handle it. In other words, the people that are well paid and can work remotely, they tend to be under less of a burden than those where it is that they have to work in public or they're dependent on public interfacing activities in order to survive. And I think, what I'm looking for you to respond to is, for instance, with restaurants, first they're open, now they're not open. Many have invested significant amounts of money in doing what they think are complying. But some of the standards seem to be somewhat nonsensical because, for instance, eating outside, but if now they're saying that you can't even eat outside in most cases. Just a sense from you, because you are with a research institution and you are a physician. How do these rules make sense? And what is a reasonable expectation that the public should have on how they should be able to go about their daily lives?
Well, the way that I do it, and this is, I probably spend half my day every day doing nothing but reading about the latest research and the latest policy decisions around COVID-19 in order to best guide our organization and keep our patients and staff and physicians safe. And here's what I've come to. I think we need some more simplistic understanding of this because it seems complicated when it's not complicated. The first thing is, if I may, because this will explain why and how to get to consistency. The way that you catch COVID-19 is that you ingest or inhale a large number of virus particles that have been shared by somebody else with you in your airspace. It's really that simple, which goes back to, so if you have someone who's sick and they're speaking without a mask or eating and talking without a mask as you do at restaurants, you're more likely to share virus particles. And the level of disease that you met, your odds that you're going to develop the disease, is just based on how much comes into your system and does it overwhelm your initial defenses. So if you're just walking along on the street outside where there's air circulating, there's never a high enough concentration of virus particles to infect you, virtually never. That's one of those, go out, exercise, have fun, be safe. Don't though necessarily, right, dance the tango with somebody for an hour, right? That's different than running and having them, 6 feet on your side, right? I mean, there's different things that we can do. That's in sharp distinction to being in restaurants and bars. And this is why they are bearing the brunt of this, because you cannot eat and drink. We can eat and drink alone, but when you're in a closed space, the virus is not dispersed by outside air circulation. And you're not, don't have a mask on, and you're spending a sustained period of time. And that's why they're so focused on eating and drinking.
So wait a minute. So in moving outside and putting up these big tents, you're saying that that doesn't create any more safety than exists inside a regular restaurant.
As a matter of fact, what I've seen walking around Sacramento is that it may even be worse, because in order to fit enough tables inside of the tent, people are no longer 6 feet distanced. I will say this though, if the sides of the tent are open and there's free air circulation, or there's a fan blowing in outside air, right, into the tent so that there's fresh air circulating, that will markedly decrease the risk to those dining. If it's a very closed tent, right, and there's, and they're trying to keep it really warm as you are in the winter, and they're not allowing a lot of inside air to circulate within the tent space, it actually could potentially be even worse than eating inside. And that's where all the confusion reigns. There has to be, eating outside is safe as long as you're 6 feet distance between diners, not 6 foot distance between the center of tables, right? And so that requires a pretty good distancing, hard to do in a tent. And you have to have outside air circulation. That's why flying in airplanes is actually incredibly safe. You know, there've only been 60 defined cases out of 1.2 billion passenger events on airlines. And that's because they change the air every 3 to 6 minutes inside of a cabin.
Interesting. I want to go back to this surge that we're experiencing and ask you, how is this moment different than the last spike at the beginning of the pandemic? Because it seems like that the severity and the risk is even higher at this moment than back in March when we were all caught flat-footed by this thing.
Right. Well, I think there's three things that have happened that have made people less concerned. First, we're tired. And so we're not obeying the rules as closely and as seriously as when the initial shutdown order was issued in the middle of March. There's just people. Then there's number two, there's a lot of misinformation and disinformation. I find it amazing to believe there's still people who think that COVID is overhyped, that the numbers are not true. I'm just amazed. I say, just please come to my hospital and see people struggling to breathe, and you will not think this is just the flu, because it's not. And the third thing is we've come to realize, frankly, that it can move through the younger segments of our population. And there really is an extremely low incidence of mortality if you're under the age of 50. But it still remains the fact that you can catch it and give it to your loved one, your parent, your grandparent, your uncle, your boss who may be older. And they're gonna die. And that's not okay. It's just, but we've come to accept that. And I find that disturbing.
Let's talk a little bit about what's next. What's been UC Davis's participation in the development of the SACS vaccines that are beginning to be talked about and deployed?
Right. So we've been involved from day one with the Pfizer vaccine. We were one of the major recruitment sites and also one of the most active recruitment sites in terms of getting diverse individuals into the study. It is absolutely critical that when we develop medicines, all segments of our population are equally represented to make sure that all parts of our population will be served well by a new medicine like this vaccine. So we're very proud of that. And we're proud that our community had enough faith in us to sign up for the vaccine trial. We also are one of seven organizations across the state of California that will be the recipient of the first lot of vaccines, not for us personally, but because as a research university, we have excess deep cold storage. So we're expecting that there will be about 327,000 doses that are delivered within a week, and that we imagine a seventh of those will end up in Sacramento, and we'll be distributing them as defined by our public health officials.
You're also working on an app, are you not, for doing some sort of tracing or something like that?
We are. We developed an internal app, and we actually have moved now to California COVID Notify, which is the app by Google and Apple. And we really believe that everybody should voluntarily sign up for that app. And it will actually provide us some knowledge so that if we've been around someone for a sufficient period of time where they might have shared their virus with us, and they voluntarily report that they are COVID positive, we will get a notification that we should either quarantine ourselves or get tested to make sure that we're not spreading it further to our loved ones. Because there's still a lot of asymptomatic spread among the relatively young and healthy, and we might not know we have it.
As a layperson, one of the things that's a little bit confusing about the deployment of the vaccines is, given how geometrically COVID is spreading and people are coming down with it, a lot of us will go through the entire cycle. And there's an assumption that we'll have some form of immunity already. Should people who've already recovered from COVID be taking the vaccine, or at least be last in line because of some sort of immunity that they have, at least short term, right, initially?
So that's a great question, Scott. I don't think it's been settled at a national level. If you're asking my personal opinion, in order to use the vaccine that we have to derive the greatest social good, those who have had COVID-19 for sure with 100% diagnosis probably should get an antibody test to make sure they have a relatively high amount of antibodies still circulating in their blood. And then I would say that they should defer from getting the vaccine until those who have not. I know a lot of people think that we should just let this rip and go to herd immunity. That's also another one of those false assumptions. A million Americans will die if we just don't do something. So getting the vaccine to the population, that's the answer. And combining that and getting to herd immunity through using the vaccine for people who have not previously been exposed to the disease will get us there in the fastest possible manner.
Along those same lines, one of the things that has been in the press as of recent is on the scheduling of who gets the vaccine in what order. I recently read a contrarian view that said we're doing exactly the opposite of what we should be doing because the front level healthcare workers and the aged and those who have very severe health conditions should be the last to get it because if there's a problem with the vaccine, they are either more at risk of having a significant negative consequence, or these are the people that we need to make sure don't have negative consequences. Can you respond to that?
Sure. I'm 100% convinced that these vaccines are not only safe, but have been vetted absolutely appropriately. And while we don't know 100% for sure whether there may be some really long distance impacts, you never know until vaccine's been out for years. But at least in the short term, we have at least 6 months worth of data from the FDA that suggests there are no serious long-term consequences, and there is no hidden issue around, well, you may prevent the easy disease, but not the serious disease. The vaccine seems to prevent really serious disease in those who have gotten the vaccine. At least in the Pfizer vaccine, it seems as if even the first single shot will confer some degree of immunity within 10 days of the first shot. And I will tell you that personally, when it is offered to me, according to my tier, and I will accept it, I will take it, and I am confident that it's the right thing to do.
When, based on your understanding of when the vaccine is available and going to be deployed, when do you think that things will start to return to normal?
My best guess is somewhere in the April to June timeframe. I believe by then there will be, unfortunately, enough people who have been exposed to the disease and a sufficiently large number of vaccinated individuals that we can begin to really reduce the spread even as we return to our workplaces and our commercial interactions. We still will have to say anybody who has not had the vaccine or not has not been diagnosed with the disease will still need to keep their social distance and will still need to wear masks. But we begin to get a glimmer of normalcy by the time this rolls out to the general population, which again should be the second quarter and at the latest through the summer. I am confident that before the next flu season comes, the United States of America will be back on solid footing.
And one of the things that we've all noticed that there has been an absence of over the past couple of months is even though the virus began in China, we don't hear much about China anymore. And it seems that there are a number of geographies, China, Taiwan, others, that have gotten back to normalcy so much quicker than we have. What is it, to your understanding, that they did differently than we did that has allowed them to even get that far ahead without having a vaccine available?
Yeah, they wear masks. Their culture is around wearing masks in public and on public transport all the time, because they're not only worried about coronavirus, they were worried about the very dense, packed urban areas, very populous areas, where people spread all sorts of viruses and diseases, right? And so it was very easy for them to adapt to the need for a mask. And those exact societies have done the best. So when you say, what's different? It's wearing a mask. And you may say, oh, well, but some of those are poor. Taiwan's not a poor country. They're just like us. Japan's not a poor country. They're just like us. They're in urban populated areas. They just all wear masks. And if we just did that, we could get back, or at least keep things pretty normal until the vaccine is fully distributed in this country. That's really it. And that's my one plea to all the people out there who are listening. When in public, when you're inside, wear a mask, and don't go to large crowds where people are not wearing masks under any circumstances, because that's just a really high risk event.
And I think we'll leave it there. And thank you, Dr. Lebarski, and good luck to both you and your team and all of the healthcare professionals fighting on the front lines for all of us.
Thank you, Scott. And on behalf of those individuals on the front line, I just want to make sure they know how thankful everybody is for their incredible and heroic work every day.
All right. And that's our show. Thanks to our guests, and thanks to you for watching Studio Sacramento. I'm Scott Syphax. See you next time right here on KVIE.
Thank you for listening to Studio Sacramento from KVIE Public Television. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes to help others find it.
All episodes of Studio Sacramento, along with other KVIE programs, are available to watch online at kvie.org/video.
This Studio Sacramento episode is supported by UC Davis Health, where doctors, nurses, and researchers share a passion for advancing health. Learn more about their latest medical innovations at health.ucdavis.edu.